Hello, and welcome to the Poetry Universe. So today we welcome Dr. H.L. Hicks to the Poetry Universe. Dr. Hicks is a distinguished poet and scholar of creative writing, philosophy, and theology who has always pressed the boundaries of literature. He has published numerous ambitious poetry works such as Rational Numbers, Chromatic, and the more recent American Anger, and another work, The Gospel, which is an amazing integrated version of the four Gospels combined with other related ancient texts, packaged with some rather ingenious contemporary language. His awards include the T.S. Eliot Prize, the Peregrine Smith Award, and fellowships from the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Kansas Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council. He earned his PhD in philosophy from the University of Texas at Austin. He's taught at various universities, including Kansas City Art Institute, the Cleveland Institute of Art, and the aforementioned University of Texas. His latest soon-to-be-released work, Say It Into My Mouth, is again a monstrously groundbreaking work which defies any single categorization in my view. It is both a work of first principles philosophy as well as a list book of thought-provoking quotations that mirror the very structure of the biblical Proverbs. Please welcome H.L. Dr. Hicks.
Hey, thanks. Thank you for that generous introduction. You know, we all sort of work in our little hovels, our garrets, and it often sort of feels, it can feel alone and it can feel futile. And that sort of generosity of introduction is like sustaining. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with your works. I have a number of your books. Phil Brady introduced me to them some time ago. First, I read Rational Numbers, then Chromatic, and then a whole host of others. Also, Demon Strategy, which is that it's not poetry, but it's that's an amazing work. We'll talk about that some other occasion. But there's just too much. You've published. Yeah. You have an amazing dossier when it comes to creative writing and philosophy and poetry. So what I'd like to start with is, can you give us a general overview or summary of Say It Into Your Mouth and tell us what prompted you to write this book?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, Say It Into My Mouth has three parts to it. And they each of them originated separately and you know, sort of developed on its own before that the little epiphany came that wait a minute, these things belong together, and so the separate projects are one of them is a set of you know, I would call them self interviews, but with a twist or two that instead of one person and interviewer asking a question and another person responding to that question with a statement of some sort, it's one, a question is posed and it's answered by another question and so on. So it sticks to questions. And then of course the other twist is that none of the words are my own. They're each of the questions is directly quoted from some other source. I got interested at some point in my reading, I just got interested in questions and the presence of questions and what happens with a question when it's recontextualized, and what happens to a question when it, becomes an answer. So that was what led to that, project. And another project in the book is a translation of the ancient Greek thinker Heraclitus, usually classified as a pre-Socratic philosopher. And I've been preoccupied with Heraclitus for a long, long time, starting in graduate school, really, and have made various stabs at translating Heraclitus. And so one peculiarity of this particular translation, for instance, a previous translation of Heraclitus was a section in my poetry collection, Rain Inscription. And so what I tried there was reassembling what has come down to us in fragments. We don't have the complete work that Heraclitus wrote. What we have is little pieces that other people have quoted in their own works and so on. And so in the version in Rain Inscription, I tried sort of putting them together into a single poem. And here, what I did was to put I'm making little scare quotes in the air, a normal translation of Heraclitus with a translation that is not my words, but words directly quoted from other people, and also words that are not their translations. They didn't utter those words or write down those words with any connection to Heraclitus in mind. It's just, I just view them as related to the passage of Heraclitus that's being translated from Greek. And so that's the second project. I'm sounding very long-winded to myself here. but the third project is juxtaposing the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein with the poet Leslie Scalapino. So Wittgenstein was an Austrian philosopher, very significant in terms of philosophy in the 20th century, very, very significant figure. Leslie Scalapino was I'll call her contemporary. She's passed away, I believe, in 2010. But a very, very recent contemporary American poet from the Bay Area, often associated with the language poets. And so at some point I just noticed a correlation between a passage that Wittgenstein had written talking about the importance of writing philosophy as a poetic composition and Scalapino's assertion that poetry in our time is doing the work of philosophy. And so I thought those were interesting. And then as soon as I went back and started looking, of course, there were a lot of other correlations. So even though Wittgenstein couldn't have known of Scalapino's work because she's after him, and there's no indication that she had any special interest in Wittgenstein. I'm sure she was aware of Wittgenstein, but I don't have any reason for thinking that she had a special interest in Wittgenstein. And so the correlation is not a kind of association or influence of some sort. It's just that their minds were going on some kind of related track. And so it ends up, it just ended up finding 82 pairs of passages that seemed related to one another. And I just wanted to listen to them. So I had just sort of put them side by side and then associated other things with them. And so then the moment of revelation, of course, was that all three of those projects, they all consist essentially of quotations from others rather than quote my own words. So then that was what made it seem like they sort of had to be together. And that was what generated this whole book, Say It Into My Mouth.
Yeah, that's actually, I wanted to quote that other part that you mentioned, poetry and philosophy, the comparison. And I'll get to that a little later, but I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, so, you know, the other thing that's really provoked my curiosity as I was going through it, and this is true of all your books, but it's easier for me to to group your other books into some particular genre. They're mostly poetry, but this one, it sits somewhere between philosophy and poetry. So what genre would you say this book is really in? Is it really a work of philosophy written in poetic language, or is it a combination? Because you have a number of different elements in here, and you mentioned a lot of it is not, you're basically making quotations and you organize them. I understand that. But is it your intention to lean more towards the philosophical treatise in this case?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to, if I had to choose one standing genre, I think I would say philosophy. There too, the origins are different. The self interviews, the first section, originally I was thinking of them, as poetry. And the translation of Heraclitus, he's usually called a pre-Socratic philosopher, but, I've argued in print before that that's a mistaken categorization of what is doing. Of course, Wittgenstein and Scalapino are usually, one is usually categorized as a philosopher and one is usually categorized as a poet. And both of them were interested in questioning that opposition. And I am too. I think the way we use genres can be, it creates certain sorts of freedom and certain sorts of possibilities, and certain sorts of vision, but also constrains certain sorts of vision. And so a very great number of the people that I am interested in, writers that I'm interested in historically, are people who they've reinvented the genre that they have been working in, or they have merged genres, or it's been somehow questionable what sort of genre they're in. That seems to, it connects with your own interests, as I have.
I'm trying to make eclectic works also. There's a lot of crossover in the various genres. I mean, I'm obviously not an advocate of the Socratic idea that poets should be, you know,
right,
you know, we should get rid of all the poets because they produce a different type of truth. And, you know,
they're working on it in Florida.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, no. So I'm trying to go and build bridges between the various genres. And it's, and I think you are, I don't think I know you are doing the same on a different, and using different platforms and different genres, and maybe yours is more philosophical poetry. I'm trying to, my stuff is sometimes more esoteric philosophy, and, you know, encased in this visual poetic universe that I am trying to create. I do ascribe to a lot of what you're trying to do as well. One of the things I notice with this particular work, and as well as with the gospel, your earlier work, I see a lot of Platonic, Aristotelian, as well as biblical wisdom books influence in this work. And so this work to me is more like a teaching treatise, maybe more of I felt as if I was reading a book of principles or a manual for living. Which is, so, and I'll give you an example of that. Just on page 35, if I can quote, the way you're writing this or the way you quoted this, humans live whole lifetimes in denial of logos or logic before the hearing and after having heard. Though all follows from logos, they act like the untreated, the way they treat the diagnosis of words and works, explicating each symptom and side effect. Most humans are little attentive to what they do while awake as they are alert to their doings in sleep. So yeah. This is more like, all right, so, and, you know, in the same, along the same vein, let's see. One thus confronts a self both limited and boundless, born to die and born to live. The creature is also the creation and responsible endlessly for that perpetual act of creation, which is both the self and more than self. That's a very profound lines there. I love this, you know, but, and the third one in the same area, you know, general location, get used to it. War is solidarity and justice is conflict, and everything occurs by conflict and mandates. So these are like, to me, it's more of a list of, all right, if an alien stepped onto the earth, this is what this is what it is here, you know. And this is great. I love this stuff. Especially when you write, you further write, poetry is never a personal possession. And then the poem is, it was a vision and gesture before it became sign and coded exchange in a political economy of value. So the thing about these lines, each one of them provokes further inquiry and much larger discussion. Each one can be taken as its own exposition to a larger treatise or a larger work. Is, and I'm sure that's what you're the effect you were having. You wanted people, or you want people to think, as all philosophers do. You want people to question. Right. And that is excellent. And then you further on page 59, you write, I think I summed up my attitude to philosophy when I said philosophy ought really to be written as poetic composition. Poetry in this time and nation is doing the work of philosophy. That's what you said before. And it is writing that is conjecture. So these are, the way I'm reading this entire work, it's, like I said, it's more of a book of principles, but at the same time, you're including all kinds of like marvelous little interjections of different poets and structures of different poets. I actually, let me see if I can find it. There's one line in here that just got me. This was, this line made me think of a Hebraic verse as well as Walt Whitman, because he was wrote in this style. The self-knowledge philosophy urges has less to do with what I know about myself than with how I know myself. Mm-hmm. So it's very, and the self-transformation poetry invites has less to do with who I am than with how I am. It's, I hear almost Walt Whitman saying this. It's so, this work is more, it has elements of the Proverbs in here. I mean, it's just very, is this what you were after when you wrote this? I guess that's what I'm trying to ask. Maybe I'm not asking it well.
Absolutely. I've always felt very affected by gatherings of this will sound pejorative, but like nuggets of wisdom. This is, you know, I mean, philosophy is supposed to be the love of wisdom, and I think we often sort of drift into a concern with knowledge. You know, we live in a society that's very obsessed with data. And I suspect that's a mistake of, you know, substituting them means for the end. And that, you know, what we want data for is for wisdom. I think what we want most anything for is wisdom. And so I love works like, you know, Heraclitus is a great example of a person who, what we have at least from him is in very compact form. And as a reader, as a recipient of that form, you have to yourself undertake the labor of unfolding it. You have to be the one who pays attention and who sorts out what it means. You know, there's a kind of amazing tradition of such things. We have sort of collections of maxims or proverbs or principles. I'm thinking of Gratian or Marcus Aurelius or Antonio Porcia, and so I've always been fascinated by those, maybe because it's a way that I feel like I am able to enter into. I very often feel overwhelmed by the, you know, longer continuous works, Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. I feel overwhelmed by an attempt to hold together an argument that is presented over a sustained, lengthy exposition. I often feel as though I get lost in the middle, that I'm only able to see a small portion at a time. And things.
Yeah, Immanuel Kant was definitely Kant was definitely one of those that, and also Heidegger. Those two, especially.
Yeah.
I mean, all the philosophers. I mean, a lot of them, but those particular ones I found to be the most challenging. When I read Kant many years ago, his Critique of Pure Reason, it seemed like maybe three minds at once telling me all these things. It was a lot to absorb.
I was so surprised. My undergraduate philosophy professor once advised me, I have no idea. He's passed away now. I can't ask him to find out. But so I don't know if this was in jest or seriously. But he once advised me, always read when you're reading philosophy, always read primary sources. Except Kant, he said, just read secondary sources.
Well, Kant, I think, was the beginning of the very condensed philosophy treatise. I don't know. Many people would argue with me and say it was maybe Aristotle because of all the large volumes of information that was in there. But Aristotle was, to me, more accessible, even though there's tons of information in there. I'm still reading it. I still revisit these things. And Kant also. But when it got to be into the more, people like Hegel and later Heidegger Heidegger was a real, that was a lot of challenge when I read that one too. But the point is that these are, I understand what you're saying, that, you can look at it from fractions of the views, the points of view. And it's, I think that's better and more approachable to the current population, to get them to understand things, to give them snippets of it. If you overwhelm people with Kant, for example, someone on that magnitude. So for this, this where we've already talked about. All right, you mentioned also the current state of poetry. You know, when I look at these types of works, I always think, all right, how can we get this to be more accessible to larger audiences that are not familiar with poetry or these thoughts? And I guess what I'm trying to ask is twofold. When you approach writing one of these works, which is large scale, mm-hmm. which this is, do you take into account a particular writing process that will say, well, how am I going to say this so that larger masses can understand it? Or do you take a more of an organic approach to it? It's just, I guess, you know, I'm very interested in your writing process because I also have my own writing process. Every writer does, but it's just, I'm just trying to get more information. I'm sure my listeners and viewers will be interested also when once they read your amazing books. It's just, it begs the question, how do you approach writing these things?
Yeah. I do think that process is important in writing, and I share your sense that we, all of us, we find or make up or are shown, processes, what we want is a process that is itself revealing. What I want out of writing is, I want a means for focusing my own attention and heightening my own awareness. I want a vehicle that gives me more of my own experience, that lets me participate more fully in my own experience. So for me, the writing is first and foremost, if there's an analogy with one of the senses, the analogy is really with hearing. I take writing as a form of listening, rather, for instance, than primarily a form of speaking. So I think we're accustomed to making the analogy of, writing is a kind of variant of speaking. So we write something down in order to preserve it, but what we're preserving is something that in its essence is spoken. And so it's a kind of, writing is a kind of secondary or diminutive speech. But I take it as an act of listening, so it means that audience remains a mystery to me. I hope
that's interesting. That
there's a kind of communion created, but I don't understand myself to be, conveying to an audience member something that somehow I know. I hope that it's a little bit like you mentioned Whitman, that lovely moment in Whitman, my left arm hooking around the waist, my right hand pointing to landscapes of continents in the public road. My hope is that that the audience is, that it's not me looking at somebody and telling something, that it's the two of us standing side by side and sharing a vista.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a very good depiction of what I'm trying to do as well with the visual poems. It's more, what I'm trying to do is give the audience snippets of certain things, whatever viewpoint or that, whatever character or voice I'm using in the works. I want them to see it from that person's point of view. It's the same. So that's, I think, we're in sync. And that was, I'm glad you mentioned that. So to that vein, I have to ask your opinion on the current state of technology, artificial intelligence, social media for, conveying poetic and philosophical ideals or ideas, principles. Do you think that, given the strange, dystopia that we currently live in with respects to technology, where do you see this all going, let's say in the next 50 to 100 years? Do you really think that people will still consume poetry in its current state in another 50 years, as well as philosophy, if there's not a convergence of all of those medias? See, a lot of what I'm trying to do is trying to get more poets interested in the technology aspect of things. They're not going to do exactly what I do. I would not never expect anyone to do, you know, one poet to do the same thing as another. But, you know, I think there should be more bridges built in this vein. But and I think you are doing a lot of this with even within just the hard copy poetry. You are crossing into many different areas. Where do you see the current state going? You know, like the poetry genre going in the next 50 years, let's say.
Yeah. I suspect that we don't have. I suspect we don't have any way to foresee very clearly the effects because I suspect that we're in the middle of a technological change that that is changing us. It's changing who we are as individuals. There's plenty of evidence that one's media of communication physically alter the patterns of connection of the neurons in the brain. So there were studies done that showed this in terms of writing. A person who can read and write, your brain's just wired differently than somebody who is not. And there's growing evidence that the same is true for digital media, that a kid growing up now with, you know, cell phones and whatever other screens, interactive kinds of screens, visual information and so on, that it's literally wired differently than someone like me who is old enough to have, I purchased my first computer while I was in graduate school. All of this has happened since I was an adult. So it's literally wiring us differently. It's connecting us to one another differently, in ways that are very, very difficult to sort out, but that are suggested by things like Kwame Anthony Appiah's book, Cosmopolitanism, for example, who talks about ways in which we're now interconnected. So the consequences of my actions affect people that I'll never meet. I don't even know who it's affecting.
It's true. It's true. All of what we're doing. This very podcast is going to go across to people that I will never know who.
Exactly.
You will never know who's listening, and it will influence other people.
Absolutely.
So I do agree. Like it's rapidly changing, especially with artificial intelligent software that's available, that's freely available to even to younger people. But I think one of the things I'm trying to do is grab the bull by the horns, the whole cliche. We need to use it. We need to use this, and we need to get on the wave. I think that's where it should be, because irresponsible technology has caused disasters in the past, and we are the people that should be driving what is communicated. Writers with integrity, like many people, so that the canon of knowledge is not lost,
right?
To artificial intelligence. And this is very, it can be discouraging if you look into what's actually happening with some of the software out there. I don't know if you're familiar with things like ChatGPT or this other thing called Midjourney. I take a look at it. It might scare you a little bit, but if you're not familiar with it, it's basically you give the computer a few commands and it creates certain things. It makes decisions. So you can ask, you create an account, you go online and you say, oh, paint me something in the style of Rembrandt, and then give it a subject matter, color scheme. And after a few seconds, it will create something like that. So it affects photography. It affects everything. So I'm just, at some point, they might try to do that with writing, like write me something in style of Walt Whitman. So you can have the computer making all kinds of these decisions. But I think the solution to all of this is really to have us driving it, us keeping our eye on it, because that's really where mistakes can be had if we're not vigilant. And that's one of the dangers of having this thing in place without, you know, others. Like I said, we hundreds, thousands of years of knowledge of what humans have done shouldn't be left to the requirements of artificial intelligence. And that's my whole thing. So we should be using it rather than just being a disengaged participant or spectator.
Or naive participants. Not aware, for instance, of ways in which the sort of digital world reproduces and reinforces problems in the physical world, non-digital world. I'm just thinking of things like this book,
Algorithms of Oppression.
So by a scholar, Safiya Umoja Noble, and she traces in this book ways in which the search engine aspect of Google reproduces racist tropes and so on, just does simple things like shows what comes up when you key in as your search terms black girls on Google, what comes up versus what comes up with other search terms.
And I'll get that book. I'd be interested in reading it.
It's a fascinating and powerful book, and a reminder that the way that digital phenomena are widely understood in culture, or widely taken for granted in culture, as if they're neutral sources of information, is a terrible and, that, you know, as you're saying, dangerous mistake. They're far from neutral things.
Yeah, no, it's because
their influence is very, very extensive. So, I certainly concur that this is, something that it behooves us to try to manage wisely disport ourselves toward as reflectively as possible, and engage in ways that that at least seek to preserve something of what we ourselves value. Difficult though that.
I don't know if we'll be successful. I don't know if we'll be successful, but I think it's incumbent upon us as writers, as keepers of the canon of knowledge, we need to try to take the reins. Whether we're going to be, sink into oblivion is one thing. I don't know. I got to try it though.
Yeah.
And I encourage, anyone, that writes this kind of work to do it. You can do it on different levels, whatever comfort level, you're interested in it. As far as your work, Harvey, and I know we got kind of on a sidetrack there, a sidebar. Mm-hmm. I think this is a marvelous work. This Say It Into Your Mouth is most of your, actually all of the books I have of yours are quite amazing. I think this one is maybe your best, at least in my opinion, but it could be, you know, I go back and forth with a few of them. I actually liked The Gospel and American Anger very much, which is, I don't, at some point, maybe we can have another chat like this and we can talk about your earlier works, because I have a lot of questions, not so much questions, but just I'd like to go over some of them for the benefit of better understanding of your work, as well as, you know, I'm sure people listening to this would be interested in understanding them as well. And I'll be putting all the links to your work in at the bottom of this podcast, and the when I eventually put this on the YouTube channel, that'll take longer. I'll put it on the podcast earlier, probably a week or so before, and because I have to edit the videos and so forth.
Right.
Like I said, I would also be pleased if I could ask you to come back in the future to discuss some of these earlier works.
Sure.
And
although
each one of them could be an episode in itself.
Right.
But, you know, I really want to thank you for joining me today. The links to some of selected works of Dr. Hicks are listed in the description to this podcast episode. Please look for the video version of this podcast to be published soon on YouTube. I will be posting more visual poems soon as well. Until then, I once again invite all to embrace the muse and to seize the night.